Welcome to Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. I would be Bradshaw. That would be the WWE Hall of Famer and Oklahoma's most favorite son, Mr. Gerald Briscoe. And when you have a name that transcends the medium that made you, that's when you know you got it made. The moments that he had with Andy Kaufman on the David Letterman show have been called in the top 50, the top 100, the top 25 greatest list in television history. He is synonymous with Memphis, or Memphis is synonymous with him. He is the king, Mr. Jerry Lawler. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Oh, King, man, that's great. It's so awesome to have you on here. What John said, I mean, you know, everything about you. You know, finally we got somebody on here that I can relate to age-wise. And you know, I'm not going to insult you by saying you're my age, but I got you by a couple of years. But we're in that same time frame. You started in the 70s. I started in 68. But what a great time. We caught the tail end of some of the greatest legends of this business, like the Lou Thesz, the Buddy Rogers, the Wild Red Berries, the Fargos, the Daltons, the Tojos, all those guys. You've had the pleasure of being in a ring from Lou Thesz to John Cena and everybody. And I mean everybody in the history of this business in between, man. So it's so awesome to have you on here so we can talk about some really true old days that even before that guy up there, that young kid Layfield, that he don't even know about. So welcome to the show, man.
Thank you very much. Yeah, when you mentioned those names, especially Lou Thesz, that sends me back to in the early 70s, a match I'll never forget. Me and Jim White, they had just put Jim White and I together down in Memphis and as a tag team, and we had a match against Lou Thesz and Pat O'Connor. Wow. And the special referee was Jersey Joe Walcott,
wow,
the ex-boxing, heavyweight boxing champion. So, I mean,
wow,
you can't, we're talking about wrestling and boxing history. Can't go much further back than that, can you?
And that was a great thing, too. Remember Jersey Joe and the Brown Bomber, Joe Louis? I mean, they used to go around, and they were referees. I remember one week I was fortunate enough to be on some big shows. I followed Joe Louis around. I think we're in, like, Kansas City. We're in St. Louis. We're in Houston. We're in Greensboro. We're in Charlotte. And we're in Richmond. And then we came down to Tampa and Miami. And Joe looked at me and he said, "Kid, everywhere I look," he said, "I see you, man." I said, "Well, everywhere I look, Joe, I see Buddy out there because I'm on the card with you." So, but that was a great time, him and Jersey Joe, and what great guys to work with. But you mentioned another guy there that's often overlooked. You know, we hear the Lou Thesz all the time, but Pat O'Connor, working
right
with him was like working with an invisible man.
Yeah, and to be in the same ring with both of those guys against them as a tag team, I mean, that was, I still, like I said, that's the first thing I want to talk about when we're talking about past history. That's my go-to match. I mean, I'll never forget after the match, Jim White was getting covered by Lou Thesz, and I came into the ring and made the save. I kicked Lou Thesz in the back, and it was so funny. After the match, Pat O'Connor came to me and said, "Kid, when you kicked Lou Thesz, you looked like you were kicking a keg of dynamite." And I said, "Yeah, well, that's because that's what I thought I was kicking."
Well, Jerry, they talk about age. You know, me, you, and Dutch Mantel all share the same birthday. Now Dutch was born a century before us. But me and you and Dutch all share November 29th, the same birthday.
Well, I'm going to tell you this. Actually, Dutch and I were born on the exact same day. We were
same year, everything.
Everything. Same day, same year, everything. Yeah. So we're cosmic brothers from different mothers or something like that. I don't know.
That's kind of like me and Tony Garrett, but Tony was born in Auckland, New Zealand, and I was born in Seminole, Oklahoma. But we figured out the time difference and everything. We were born like probably 2 minutes apart or something like
that. Oh, no kidding. And then, I think Dutch and I figured that out before, too. And Dutch, I'm glad to say, is a little older than me.
Well, the Dutch is almost older than me, but Jerry, you know, going back to your early days in Memphis, I mean, you know, Memphis is such a famous wrestling territory, was so good, you know, and had the great talent passing through there. I heard you talking to our brother Stone Cold the other day about, you know, the original owner of Tennessee, Nick Gulick. I mean, he was world famous. I'd always swore in my mind hearing these horror stories because we, you know, Oklahoma, I started in Oklahoma. We seemed to get those guys that drifted out of Tennessee up to Oklahoma, just, you know, whatever, all just surviving. I was just, you know, learning how to lace my boots up and tie my straps and tuck them in my top boot top there. They would all tell me, kid, you're just starting out. We just come from Memphis. Never go to Memphis. I'd already heard the story. Did Jack ever, not Memphis, but Nashville for Nick Gulick. Don't go work for Gulick, that's it.
Well, did you ever at that time, though, Jerry, Nick, when Nick was the promoter, Memphis, Nashville, all the cities, Nick was over all of them. He promoted all of those cities. Yeah. And he was notorious for being a horrible payoff guy. But one of the things, it was always a funny story. Like he would love to bring in Mexican wrestlers,
right?
And then he would pay them so little that they couldn't afford to leave. Yeah. They had no money to be able to get a ride out of town. So, I can understand a lot of guys thought that they had bad payoff, but fortunately in 1977, Jerry Jarrett and I, Jerry might have continued the same streak as Nick, but
that's what I heard at the beginning.
Yeah, we went into business for ourselves, and that was the end of Nick. And I certainly, it was funny, Jerry and I would trade off. He would book for 6 months, and just no matter what the date was, he would stop booking that day, and I would start booking for 6 months. And we did that for years and years and years. And so I did get the reputation of being a little bit better payoff guy than Jerry.
Yeah.
At least that's
a lot better. I can testify that, John. But Jerry, did my brother Jack ever tell you the story about when he quit the business because of Nick Gulick?
No.
And when Jack was right out of school, of course, you know, and he started in Oklahoma, of course, all those guys, you know, hey kid, if you want to make any money, you got to get out of here. You got to go somewhere, you know. So he went down to Leroy McGurk, and Leroy said, yeah, I think Leroy's trying to teach him a lesson. He said, yeah, I'll call Nick Gulick and I'll sit you down there. Well, no. Jack left. Jack was married and had three kids at the time, and just out of college. And so Leroy sent him down to Nick. Well, Jack had this old Grand Prix, and, you know, he drove, kind of like I heard Stone Cold saying, you know, he drove the car because the other guys would pay you transit and fill up your gas tank. And they were making 10, 15 bucks a night. So one night during a rainstorm, he was coming around one of those mountain curves. And this is before Interstate, of course. You started back in those days, too. And they had a landslide, and a damn big boulder landed right on the hood of Jack's Grand Prix and totaled the damn thing out.
Oh, my God.
So here's a kid. He got no money, no nobody, nothing, you know, and he's trying to get home, you know, and he's trying to go to Nick. Nick's not giving him advance or anything like that because Nick knows if he gives him any money, he's going to leave. So
yeah,
one of the guys, Sputnik Monroe, give Jack $25. Jack takes the $25, go down to Continental Trailway Station there in Nashville, buys him a one-way bus ticket back to Oklahoma, and he's quitting the business.
Oh, man.
And so Leroy called him when he got home. He told him, hey, man, I'm sorry. He sent him down to Fritz, and he started making a little money down and with Fritz and everything. But, yeah, but Nick nearly ran Jack out of the business before he ever got started.
Well, he ran me out too in like the first couple months that I was in the business. And where you're talking about, he had to be going to Chattanooga because to go to Chattanooga from Nashville, you had to go to had somebody trying to help me with a light right there.
But they were going to give you a Diet Coke there.
You had to go to the.
Ha ha ha.
Hey, I will always do it.
I know you guys
put it on do not disturb, but I don't know how to do that. But anyway, hey, you know, we talk about, and we'll get back to talking about old-time wrestlers and talking about things that make you seem old or feel old or actually realize how old you are. I just, this past week, JBL and I were both in Providence, Rhode Island for Rhode Island Comic Con. And one of the only reasons that I agreed to do that Comic Con was because two of my all-time favorite TV stars were going to be there. Wally and the Beaver. Jerry wow. Mathers and Tony Dow from Leave It to Beaver. And I watched that show my entire life as a kid growing up. And still, if it's still on today, I still watch it every time it's on. And I don't know. I heard they were going to be there. So I said, I want to go. I want to see Wally and the Beaver. And I swear to God, in my mind, I was thinking I was going to see the Wally and the Beaver from the TV show.
<You're> right.
Well, anyway, they're about the same age as me, maybe just a little bit older than me, a couple years older. And still really cool to see those guys, you know, see JBL. I don't know if there was anybody there that you got to see that you enjoyed seeing from the past or hadn't seen in a long time. But I love doing those Comic Cons just to get to meet those people.
Yeah, I do too. And King, it was funny because I've told several people the story. That's the only time I've seen you enamored by a celebrity. You know, it's funny because Undertaker was that way with Dr. J. When Dr. J once walked in the dressing room, he couldn't speak, you know, and he's Cool Hand Luke. King is the same way. I mean, Jerry Lawler's a very, very famous person. Yeah. And he was sat there, and the Beaver and Wally were sitting right next to us in the green room. And King took a photo like a fan would of them over there.
He could see my face, and Beaver was sitting at the table behind me, and I'm going, look at that. But then that was before I actually got to meet him. But then after I got to meet him, and then I sent out a tweet saying how nice it was to meet those guys and how big a fan I was of them. And the next day, Beaver's wife came down to where I was, the table that I, in the booth that I was at. And she had her phone, and somebody sent her the tweet that I'd put out about them. And she just thanked me and took my information and said that they were going to get in touch with me. They're actually coming back to Tennessee in a month or so up in Gallatin, Tennessee for a show up there. So, it was really cool to meet those guys. And like I said, a lot of times you'll meet somebody and that you're just enamored with. And then all of a sudden you realize that they're fans of yours too, or they don't know who you are. I'm just always shocked to find somebody like that. Like Lou Ferrigno. Oh my gosh. You know, the Incredible Hulk guy.
Right.
I met him through the Comic Cons and he's become just an old hand. Every time I see him, he wants me to show pictures of my girlfriends on my phone.
Your buddy was there too. You're 18 years away from, or about 20 years away from being old enough to go into space with him. William Shatner.
Yeah, Bill Shatner. Everybody, you know, he told me, you got me and JR, when we first met him, he said, call me Bill. Call me Bill. My friends call me Bill. So I always call him Bill Shatner. Yeah. But and I got to speak to him a little bit. And I asked him, he was back in the green room. And I said, what are your, what's your next Comic-Con that you're doing? And he went, oh man, I don't know, Jerry. I'm telling you, I can't even remember where I'm at next. And he said, at my age, you can't remember much stuff. And I said, I understand. He said, I'm to the point where I don't even buy green bananas. So I thought that was good.
Well, he's an astronaut, so you got to forgive him.
Yeah, exactly. He lost his mind at space there. But you know, you're talking about guys that you really liked and really enjoyed watching. I saw you post a picture with the Soup Nazi.
Oh my gosh! Yes,
I have.
What a good guy he was.
Oh, I got exactly the reverse story with this guy.
Not a good and story.
I mean, a guy was a real a-hole. I mean,
really.
I was in L.A., and I'm sitting across from Patty Duke, and Patty Duke is flirting with me, and, you know, we're talking back at each other, and I'm right there, I was a huge Seinfeld fan, so somebody said, Briscoe, you like Seinfeld, right? And I said, yeah. He said, way back over in the corner, that might have been the reason, because we're right there at the entranceway. And this guy is as far back and in the darkest corner as you can possibly get. Somebody told me the soup Nazis way back there. You know, I know you like Seinfeld. You maybe want to meet him. So I said, yeah, great. You know, so I walk, and it's a long way from where we're at. I finally get back there. Now, we're closing down. It's closing down the first day.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting there, and I walk up to him. He's packing his shit in his bag. And I go over to him. I said, hey, Soup Nazi, you know, man, I really enjoy. And I got my name tag on and everything. I said, I'm up there in front. I'm part of the show. I said, could I take a picture with you? You know, most of the time, you know, you're working those things, you take. He points down at his table and said, photos, $35.
Wow.
And I look at him, I said, go F yourself, Nazi. And I turn around, I walk out. The promoter seen me walking away. And he said, what happened? He's the one that told me to go over there. I said, the guy wanted to charge me $35. For a photo with him. He said, do you want? I said, no, I don't want one with him, man. So he said, go back. So I went back to the table. About 5 minutes later, here he comes carrying all of his bags up with the promoter by his side. He walks over to me and he apologizes and said, hey, man, I'm sorry. He said, I've had a bad day. He said, you want to take a photo with me? And I said, sure. So I stood up, I took a photo. I said, hey, by the way, Nazi, mine are $50. But man, yeah, he was just a jerk that day for some reason.
Well, you probably hit him at a bad moment because, yeah. This past weekend, he couldn't have been nicer. I mean, he just, and you know what was amazing to me? It seems like I've seen a soup Nazi on Seinfeld 1,000 times, right? And I was in shock when I asked him. I said, how many episodes were you in on the Seinfeld show?
Yeah.
You know what the answer is? One.
One? Really? I thought it was two. Yeah.
He was in only one episode. And he's so, I mean, he's famous from that he, sure, he does these Comic-Cons somewhere almost every week. Yeah. And he sells soup. He sells little soup bowls. They're really cool. He autographs, yes, the inside of a soup bowl.
I saw your soup bowl autograph. Soup, yeah,
well, that Jerry, was cool. Jerry, I got a heck of a deal. I got an autograph and a picture with King, and he only charged me $80.
Yeah, well, that was for the combo. You got a good deal.
I got a heck of a deal. Yeah. I met Lacey Underall one time. You know, she was the girl that was in the Caddyshack movie. You know, the really hot tennis chick, you know, that had, yeah, the affair, sure, with, yeah, Chevy Chase. And so they said, I said, who else here? They said, Lacey Underall. Go, oh, my God. I said, can I meet her? Well, this is like 40 years later. You know, I don't care. It's still my childhood sweetheart. So
sure,
went and took, yeah, a picture with her. It was awesome.
Yeah, I love those Comic-Cons. Yeah, I'm trying to think of who else there was. That
you know what really is amazing, King, is that Cobra Kai guy. You know, they said he was just a regular guy at Comic-Con. All of a sudden now he's the guy because of that main commercial. It's amazing the celebrity status of how people become such big celebrities.
Can you guys hear wouldn't you know it, I guess the people next door all of a sudden are having their lawn cut.
Where are you at, King?
Huh?
Where are you at? What's all the stuff behind you?
This is my bat cave. This is hang on. Let me take my phone out of this little hook and I'll give you the little.
Yeah, give us a little guided tour here. John, have you ever seen this?
I've actually been in the Batmobile and wore the bat scowl.
And unbelievable. Huh?
Okay, let's see. Let me start. Let's start over here. Like I said, everything is. Everything's sort of Superman and Batman. This is one of my prized possessions right here. This is a piece, early Superman from the newspapers, and it's signed by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Those are the guys that created Superman up in Cleveland, Ohio. And
we lost you, King.
He may be watching this. Then I got a nice 10-foot-tall Incredible Hulk statue here.
Wow.
I got Superman here. all my Superman stuff. Then over here, I got I got some of my Cleveland memorabilia. A helmet signed by the entire 1964 Browns team that won the NFL championship. All kind of stuff there. Then more Superman stuff here. I don't have all my lights on. Rat Fink, he's one of my favorites. More stuff over there.
What's your favorite item in that room there, Jerry?
I got a lot of Coca-Cola memorabilia as well.
Yeah.
And several Coke machines. Well, here's my favorite item right here, guys.
Oh, man.
The Batmobile.
Yeah. Wow. That's a replica, right? Or is that the original?
No, the original sold last year for $4.1 million.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a good replica, though. And this is actually one of the cows that Adam West wore. We got the bat phone, bat turn lever, Batman and Robin over there. And we got Spider-Man over here looking over things. And that's probably my favorite item. Got some Disney stuff down here. We got Batman and Deadpool there. Then right here, I brought this stuff down for the A&E show where they were looking for the lost items. I brought down a bunch of my robes and capes and outfits that I've worn through the years.
I see the one that you kicked my butt on that you wore the night you kicked my butt. That red
Which one.
That
Which
red
one, right
one.
Here?
That red one. Yeah, I remember seeing that one. You're kicking my butt.
Oh, please.
When we drew the biggest house in the history of Memphis.
And there's the AWA title belt that I won from Curt Hennig, and Bill Dundee and I had these AWA World Tag Team titles back in 1988. But yeah, just a bunch of crazy stuff out here.
Well, hey, John, you know, usually when somebody builds a four-car garage, especially an athlete, they're putting these big fancy, you know, hot rods and a big fancy custom classic cars. And here Lawler has a four-car garage built, and he puts Coca-Cola machines and an Incredible Hulk and stuff like that in there. That's a smart man because that stuff don't depreciate like all those hot rods do.
When I do have a real cool custom car right here on the outside, This is my favorite.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's a 2001 Lingenfelter Corvette. Lingenfelter was an engineer that worked for Chevy and Corvettes, and he designed a special racing package for the Corvette engine. That thing will go like 210 miles an hour.
And have you been 210?
Have I been going 210?
Yeah.
No. No. As JR would say, it would be a good thing I'd wear black pants if I did. Hang on. Let me get this thing.
Hey, King, speaking of memorabilia, I was texting with a mutual friend of ours, a colleague today, and I don't want to bring up something maybe negative, but he was the one that got you through one of your biggest matches in your history when you were just a green guy trying to get started and stuff, and that was Hammer and Tongs Cole, also known as Michael Cole. So,
yeah. Hammer and Tongs Cole. Yeah, well, you know what was good about that though was I can't knock it because out of almost 30 years being in the WWE, I made my biggest payday ever working with Michael Cole. So wow. you can't knock it. And my only WrestleMania match, 30 years, that's the only one match I ever had at WrestleMania.
He had heat. I mean, you know, he had heat.
Yeah, he did. He really did. Yeah, I mean, that was, I don't know, I guess why they didn't go further with that or whatever. But anyway, I mean, it all went well, except for I can never get over the fact that the the anonymous general manager reversed the decision after I made him tap out and awarded him the victory, you know.
The greatest thing ever is when it's with you, me, and Cole around, and Cole mentioned he's undefeated. And no matter where we are, you always correct him. No, I won that match.
Well, that's when wrestling was real. You know what I mean?
Exactly. All the great matches you had, all the incredible people you wrestled with, from Pat O'Connor and Luthez, and you end up in WrestleMania with Michael Cole.
Yeah. And also, all the famous wrestlers and all the great wrestlers that I wrestled with, my most memorable match was with a 150-pound comedian, Andy Kaufman.
That's right.
You know, King, at least you didn't have to wear a dress.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, some of the people that wound up in the WWE had to do some. What about Terry Taylor was the Red Rooster? Even poor Dusty Rhodes, at first he had to be the plumber with the polka dot or whatever.
The polka dots, yeah.
Polka dots and so many people.
And we had Ron Simmons on last week, you know, Farouk, you know.
Yeah.
So.
With his blue helmet.
And yeah, exactly. And the other thing that I don't know how I missed was poor JR was the founding member, I think, but I didn't have to join the Kiss My Ass Club from Mr. McMahon.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I still remember when they had, they got a tape of it somewhere when the character was a Big Dick. He was the writer.
Johnson. DJ. DJ.
DJ. Dick, they called him yeah. Big Dick or something.
Big Dick Johnson. Yeah.
Big Dick Johnson. Yeah. Yeah. Big Dick Johnson.
Oh my God.
Big Dick, whatever. Big Johnson. When he got up on this, they got up on the table. Were you with JR when he punched him in the balls?
Oh gosh, I don't remember that.
So at the end of the show, yeah. You know, they used to always do stuff. You know, they'd mess with me and Cole. They'd mess with me. Sure. You know, they mess with JR. So Dick Johnson gets on the table in his diaper. You know, he's a funny character. You know, he's off the character off of SNL. You know, he's squirting baby oil everywhere. And King and JR says, "What's the over under? I punch him in the balls." And I think it was you that said, "I dare you." And he punched him. Square the nutsack. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. He grabs them, falls over, rolls off, and you guys just walk to the back. It was so good.
Yeah, I never. Yeah, JR hated that gimmick. He hated for that. You know, he hated for us to have to say something that crude and elementary, you know, is calling somebody Big Dick Johnson. I mean, like, you know, it was just, he hated it.
You know, the first time I just sat down and commentary with you guys, I learned the difference between a color commentator and a play-by-play guy. I sit down and we're in a commercial break and JR has pages of notes. I mean, pages. And they are taped here, taped there, sticky notes here, stuff here, throws here. And I look over and King is drawing somebody in the front row. That's all he's got. This is awesome.
That used to make JR so mad when I would do it. And then it got to where, you know, we had a format sheet that had page after page. They were usually about 15 pages long of all the page after page of the format. And I would draw a doodle or something, Batman face or Superman, something on every single page of mine. And it got to where after a while, our the production guy that was working, that was sitting beside us after the show, would always grab my run sheet because then he told me later that he was saving them all because he said, one of these days I'm going to put out a little book of all your artwork that you did during Raw.
Hey, well, King, tell me the time. I think you told me this. I was trying to remember it that I couldn't find it in any interview you did when I think it was Vince McMahon Sr. and the NWA meeting, and they said, "Who was this that beat on?" You remember the story? The story.
Of course, I remember it. Well, it goes back to Bill Apter. I don't know if you guys know him, but I don't know how many wrestling fans know Bill Apter. I mean, he's Bill Apter goes back way before all of us. In the he was in the wrestling magazine business, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and all of those I think at one time they put out about five titles out of the company that he worked at in New York. And the great thing about Bill was, I don't know how, I think I just started sending him some stuff, and I didn't realize that he was always excited to get photographs and stories from other territories around the country, because all they were able to do on their budget was just cover the Northeast, cover right up there in the WWE territory, or Vince's territory at Vince Senior. And so I would send him pictures every week. And he would call me up and say, man, keep sending me stuff. He said, I'll put anything you send me. And that was honestly, that was really a major way that I got myself known around the country, because, you know, back in the territory days, you were only seen in your territory on your local TVs and that sort of stuff. So I would send pictures about our matches up to Bill, and Bill would put them in Pro Wrestling Illustrated. And we all know in those days, I mean, if you were in the wrestling magazine, you were as big as, I mean, you know, I mean, if I'm in a story right beside Bruno Sammartino or something, the people didn't know the difference. You're all big stars if you're in the wrestling magazine. So we got Andre, Vince Sr. sent Andre down to our territory. You know how they used to send him down to each territory for like a week. And somebody would drive him around the territory, and he'd work like in our territory. He worked Memphis on Monday and Louisville on Tuesday and Evansville Wednesday and through the week, and then he'd fly back out. So on Tuesday night in Louisville, Kentucky, we had a match. And naturally, you know, nobody beat Andre. But he did somehow, I think Jerry Jarrett asked him if he would go for a count out. And I think we had Sam Bass there as my manager or something. But anyway, we did a thing where Andre and I fought out onto the floor, and we're fighting back and forth, and I rolled back in the ring. And as Andre started back in the ring, Sam, I believe, grabbed his foot from underneath. And so he couldn't make the count. So I got the count out victory. Well, I sent the pictures. I sent all the pictures in to Bill after, right? The next day, I mean, I sent them right in. So Bill calls me up after he got the pictures. He said, oh my gosh, these are great pictures. And he says, there's such a size difference in the two of you guys. He said, I want to write a story, you know, talking that you got the victory, but do you mind if I refer to you as a midget? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I wanted to put the title on the front page of the magazine, The Night a Midget Beat Andre the Giant. Uh-huh. And I said, no, whatever you want, Bill, that's fine with me. So sure enough, the next month, man, here it comes out. You know, The Night a Midget Beat Andre the Giant. Man, great pictures of me and Andre all out there. I mean, it was like the highlight of my career to get that much coverage with the biggest name wrestler in the world in the national magazines. Well, I didn't really even think a thing about it, but then a few months later, it came time for the NWA convention that they had in Las Vegas. And this was like I said, Jerry Jarrett and I were first in business. So it may have been like 1978 or so. And we went to the convention as promoters for the first time ever. And we're sitting in there around all the, you know, there's all, like you said, there's Leroy McGurk and there's Vince McMahon Sr. And there's, Harley Race and Terry Funk are all there, and Paul Bosch and all the great promoters in the country were sitting in this meeting. And somebody gets up at the podium and says, guys, we need to talk about something that's looming in our future that may really affect the whole business. It may be real detrimental to us. And he said, we're hearing a lot of word about something that's coming on the horizon called cable television. And I think we all need to be aware of that and how dangerous it could be. And so about that time, Vince McMahon Sr. steps up to the podium and he says, and Jerry and I are sitting about the middle of the pack there and had no idea what he's going to say. And he says, I'm going to tell you guys something right now. You don't need to worry about cable television. That's not going to be any problem. Here's something that is killing the business, though. This is really hurting the business. And all of a sudden he reaches down and he pulls up this magazine with me on the cover of it. Right. the night a midget beat Andre the Giant. And he said, look at this stuff they're putting in these wrestling magazines. Nobody's ever beat Andre the Giant. This can kill the business by putting out false publicity like this and stories like this. Nobody's ever beat Andre the Giant. And here it says a midget beat Andre the Giant. I mean, he was like me. He was turning red. He was so mad, right? And I'm trying to slink down in my chair. And Jerry and I are like putting our heads down. And of course, Terry Funk, about three rows behind us, he sees us trying to tuck down. And he stands up and he says, well, Vince, who was the little bastard? And so anyway, I think I really may have got completely under the chair at that time. But yeah, me and Terry laughed about that for years and years, man.
And so you wonder why you got put in the ring with Michael Cole at WrestleMania.
Yeah, yeah, I think that trickle down philosophy there still worked on me.
Jerry, you were at those meetings. Was you at the meeting the year that Jack and I made our sell to Vince, and you know what was going on at that particular meeting at that time? Were you still going out to Vegas for all the meetings?
No, I promise you. We went that one time and that was it. I said, I'm not.
That was it. I'm going back there again.
Well, King, one of the things, one of the reasons you were there, because in 77, that's when you and Jerry Jarrett decided to buy the half the territory or a lot of the territory from Nick Gulas. But the whole thing came about because he was pushing George Gulas so much, and he tried to force him on the Memphis side of the territory. And that's when you guys ended up, Jerry Jarrett asked you to choose sides. And you jumped with Jarrett, took an ownership stake, and took the boys with you. And you had the first cable television wars, right? Channel 5 and Channel 13, the first head-up wars.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were the two top stations in Memphis at the time. Channel 13 was ABC, and Channel 5 was NBC. And for years, the wrestling show with Nick Gulas' wrestling show had been on Channel 13. I mean, for maybe 20 years. And it was the number one station in the market. And so many people would watch wrestling that it made whoever was on the station, or whoever was on the wrestling show, it made them big stars as well. And of course, Lance Russell, who was actually the program director at Channel 13, he hired a young guy, or he's actually doing the weather. He was like a weatherman on the show, and he was a former disc jockey named Dave Brown. And he went to Dave one day, he said, Dave, I want you to come and do the wrestling show with me. Just try it out and see if you like it. So that's how Dave and Lance got put together. And because Dave was also doing the weather, I mean, he got so big from being on the wrestling show that everybody started watching the news and the weather to see Dave Brown at night on the weather. And they became that's what made them the number one station in the city. So when I went over and just out of the blue, I walked in off the street by myself and I asked for a meeting with the general manager of Channel 5. And he came down and met with me. And I said, look, Jerry Jarrett and I are starting in business for ourselves. We're going to leave Channel 13. We're looking for another station. We would love to be here on Channel 5. And we'll have, you know, 90% of the wrestlers that you're seeing now on Channel 13 will come with us. Plus, I think we have a real good opportunity to bring Dave Brown and Lance Russell as well. And that's when the guy's eyes really perked up. To be honest with you, Dave Brown was the selling point on getting us on TV on Channel 5, because we brought Dave Brown to Channel 5 with the wrestling. They immediately put him as their top weatherman, and their news went from number 3 in the ratings to number 1 and has remained there since.
But you went head up against Nick Gulas' promotion, right?
Yeah,
and the story I heard, I saw an interview you did that he told you you're going to be out of business in a couple weeks, and pretty much that time frame was when he was out of business.
Yeah, he lasted less than a month,
and it all started over him wanting to push his son George. And
yeah, and George, you know, I mean, we've all seen that down through the years, different times, promoters pushing their son, and you know, everybody sees their own children through different eyes than the rest of the world, you know. And it's so funny that you mentioned that, because just yesterday, somebody on it was either Twitter or Facebook or something, but somebody sent me, and I had never seen it before, but somebody sent me a newspaper clipping from a match in Nashville where Jim White and I were wrestling. Luthez was on the card, a world tag team title match, and even a world title match on the same card in Nashville. And the picture, where they always usually put the picture of a wrestler or whatever, the picture in the ad was a huge picture of George Gulas, and it said special referee George Gulas making his referee debut in Nashville. I mean, that's the way Vince, I mean, that's not Vince, that's the way that Nick Gulas pushed George, and right down the people's throat. And George was like a pretty good basketball player, but he certainly didn't look like a wrestler, and he never could get it.
He also said, one of the interviews I saw, talk about the, since Jerry's here, his brother Jack was one of the biggest things that you happened to you when you're coming along. It was all, you know, the big old tough heels that beat people up, and you were a bumping heel, the chicken shit heel, you know, it's just the most fun type heel to play, no matter how big you are. Right. And you got the chance to go with Jack Briscoe, but that process was one of the things that really first made you in Memphis.
Yeah, that was the first match I had with Jack was in 1974. And and you're right. Up until that time, I don't know how much. I don't know how many times the world champion came through there. I guess a lot as like when Luthez was champion or Harley Race or whatever. But I mean, working with Jack Briscoe in Memphis as a young kid, being from Memphis, it really put me on the map. I mean, I was made after that to be in the same ring with the world champion and Jack Briscoe. And Jack was just so fabulous. I mean, you know, and a lot of people don't realize that, and I don't know if it's the same way now. It doesn't seem like it is. But the job of the world champion used to be to make whoever he wrestled look like they should be the champion. And Jack was great at that. I mean, when you wrestle Jack Briscoe, he made the fans believe in whatever, it was your hometown, he made the fans believe that you should have been the world champion somehow by hook or crook. You know, Jack still left with the title, but he was so great at that. I mean, you know, it's just, and I think, you know, I always had the, my philosophy was, if you ever get two guys in the same ring and each one of them are trying to outsell the other one, you're going to have a great match. And that's the way it was with Jack and I. I was trying to outsell him, and then he in turn outsold me. And it was just, you know, everything he did looked fantastic. And I was made after that in Memphis.
Jerry, the key word that you said there was selling. You know, it's a lost art, because these kids just actually don't have the time, I believe, to get down into a hard sell. But we had the time, and that, you're right. I mean, Jack wasn't the biggest guy in the world, and so, you know, he had to distinguish himself out from everybody else, and the way he did it was the selling and everything. And he could outsell anybody in the business. He sold so well that, I don't know if you know this story, but Eddie Graham, one night, Louis Tillett, you remember Louis? Louis got color, decided he wanted to get color on Jack, and he got color on Jack, and I thought Eddie was going to fire Louis because Louis did that. He said, "Why did you do that?" He said, "I just want to see how people react." And Eddie asked him, "Well, did they react any different?" He said, "No, the kid sells so good." He said, "Louis, you just said it right there. He sells so good by getting juice on him. You take away, you distracted from the fact of how he sells."
Yeah.
And he told Jack never to get color again the rest of your career. And he never did after that time.
Wow. That's great. Yeah. I loved working with Jack. He was awesome.
And you know, I've listened to the great thing about this is we get to do a research, and I've known you, like I said, since the beginning of your career. And so, but going back and watching some of the stuff there, you know, the original crown. It's true that you got from Bobby Shane. Bobby Shane gave it to you. That Bobby was killed later on, of course, right here in Tampa Bay, you know, in an airplane crash.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's it was funny. I had just, and this was, I think, about in 1974 as well. What year did Bobby die? Do you know?
I think it was 76 or somewhere around there.
Yeah, you're right. It was 76, because that's when I was coming down to Atlanta to work with Jim Barnett a little bit. And so I was in the dressing room there first of all, I had just worked with Jackie Fargo on TV in Memphis on Saturday morning. I made my interview, and I was just talking off the top of my head, just trying to make it colorful. And I just looked in the camera and I said, you know, Fargo, you've been the big shot around here. You've been the king of Memphis wrestling for a long time, but you're looking at the kid that's going to knock you off your throne. And so that was the last thing I said. And then that Monday night, I went over and beat Jackie. And as I was walking back to the dressing room, some young kids were slapping me on the shoulder and said, hey, you're the king now. You're the king. And I really didn't think anything about it. But then that Friday night, I went down to Atlanta, and all of a sudden, I'm sitting in the locker room, and in walks Bobby Shane. And of course, Bobby had never worked up in Memphis for us, so I didn't know that anybody was wrestling he was wrestling as King Bobby Shane.
King.
And
it's right.
Beautiful brown, and his robe draped over his shoulder. And I all of a sudden it jogged my mind about what I'd said and what those kids had said. And I said, oh my gosh, Bobby, where did you get the crown? And I mean, I told him the story. I said, I just made this interview last week. I said, if I could find one of those crowns and show up next week on TV in Memphis with that, it'd be, you know, such a hoot. It'd be awesome. And he said at that time, he said, well, you know what? And I'll never forget it. I ordered them from a place in Houston, Texas called Southern Importers. You could order, I mean, I got the magazine. I mean, I got a catalog from them, and you could order any kind of Hollywood gimmicks, mask, outfits, tiaras, crowns, and all this kind of stuff. They just made all kind of, trinkets and the really unusual kind of stuff. But he said, you order from there. He said, but you know what? I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm going for Jim Barnett down to Australia. I'm going to be down there for 3 weeks. And he said, I'm just going as Bobby Shane because I didn't want to lug all this stuff with me on the trip. And he said, why don't you do this? I'll loan you this crown and this robe, and you show up, because I was going back that night. It was Friday night. I got a midnight flight back to Memphis. And then I'd be there for TV the next morning. He said, you're going back. He said, take this thing after the show, the crown and the robe, and you can have it on TV in the morning, then order it. By the time I get back from Australia, you know, you'll have your own crown in. And so that's how it happened. Wow. I took the crown with me that night. I showed up the next morning on Memphis TV, and there I was. I crowned myself the king of wrestling and king of Memphis. And then, of course, a few weeks later, when Bobby got back from Australia, I never got to see him. Once he got back, he got killed in a plane crash down there.
Wow. Did they get heat right away when you walked out with the crown and the robe? I mean, was that, did you know right away?
Well, you know what? It was so funny. It was, that was back in the day. There were a few young kids that liked the heels, but yeah, it got major heat with most people. But there were just that little few people that thought it was the coolest thing ever. You know, I started coming in on a sedan chair, having them carry me. I mean, I played the king gimmick to the hilt there for a while.
Was Elvis already known as the king at that point?
Oh yeah. Elvis was known as the king of rock and roll. And so this just fit naturally, me being the king of wrestling. And as a matter of fact, in 1976, I believe, it's 1977, that right after that, I had this manager named Mickey Poole. And this was after Sam Bass had gotten killed in the car accident
right. Yeah.
In 1976. And so then in 77, this young guy named Mickey Poole was my manager or my... I don't even know if we called him a manager. May have called him a valet at the time, but we actually hired him to drive me on the trips. I just hated to drive. And when Sam was there, Sam would always drive to Louisville, to Evansville. And, you know, and I just have to sit over on the side and read comic books and stuff. Right. But, so we hired this guy named Mickey Poole, who I don't know if it was like he was maybe not always exactly right, you know, just a little bit off. But anyway, he was a good driver. So he was going to be driving to Louisville, and an Elvis Presley song came on. And I said, you know what would be cool? Because the news was out then that Elvis was doing this martial arts stuff. And with Kung Ri, who was a famous karate instructor down in Memphis. So I said to Mickey, I said, you know what would be cool? I said, if we could somehow get a hold of Elvis Presley and do a wrestler versus karate match, because they had already done, you know, they had done the Muhammad Ali and Inoki match, right? So I said, wouldn't it be cool? And just crazily out of the blue, he said, well, you know what? I'll tell my brother to ask him if he'd want to do that. I said, what do you mean you'll tell your brother? He said, yeah, my brother's the president of the International Club and has been for 7 years. I said, what? He said, he hangs out at Graceland out at the front with Elvis's uncle Vester and everything, right? And I said, I didn't even believe him. I said, okay, yeah, well, yeah, get your brother to ask him if you would. So the next, like 2 days later, we're driving somewhere else. And he said, oh, by the way, he said, my brother talked to Elvis's dad, Vernon Presley, and Vernon asked Elvis if he'd be interested. And they loved the idea. So Vernon Presley's going to call you. I gave him your number. I said, are you serious? He said, I swear. So, but I mean, Mickey was just known for being a goofball, and I still didn't believe him. So it was on a Wednesday, and I leave about 1 o'clock to go to Evansville, Indiana. And this was before cell phone days. So, and I was married at the time. So I get back living in Hendersonville, and I get back home that night, and my wife says, somebody called you this afternoon. He said his name was Vernon Presley. And I said, are you serious? And she said, yeah. He said he'd call back tomorrow. So then the next day, I don't know, I said, you know, it was Louisville I was going to. Then the next day I had to go to Evansville. And I waited by the phone. No call. So I went ahead and went to the town, wrestled. I get back home that night. Get home. My wife says, well, that Vernon Presley guy called again. I said, are you serious? Damn. What does it sound like? She said, it just sound like a real nice, real Southern accent guy. And he said, I said, I told him to call you in the morning. And he said, okay, he would. So sure enough, the next morning, phone rings. I pick it up. Jerry, this is Elvis's father, Vernon Presley. And I said, yeah, well, I'm sorry I missed your calls. And he said, yeah. He said, well, they got to us with the idea of you and Elvis doing something at the Mid-South Coliseum. And he said, Elvis loves the idea. He said, he loves it. And he said, but I'll never forget how he said it. He said, I'll be honest with you, Jerry, Elvis is not in too good a shape right now, but he's fixed to start working out. And he's got this tour coming up next month. And he said, he's going to work out for that. And as soon as we get back from the tour, we'll get in touch with you and we'll put this thing together. And then, of course, he died before he even did the tour.
Wow. That close. Wow.
That's unbelievable that you almost had a match with Elvis
Presley. Elvis Presley. That would have been before Andy Kaufman. So, I mean, if I'd have had that, I don't even know if I'd have got to do the Andy Kaufman match later, you know.
Wow. He's probably to tell us this. This was so interesting when I heard the story doing a little research. That when you was doing the Andy Kaufman story, and we'll get into that, but you called Vince Sr. and Vince didn't want anything to do with the showbiz aspect of it or something like that. Tell us that story.
Well, I didn't call him. Andy Kaufman.
Andy
grew up a wrestling fan in Long Island, New York. And he's told me the story when he and I were just sitting around. Andy would come down to Memphis and stay at my house. And I filmed interviews with him with a little camcorder. And we talked about his whole background for I don't know how long. But he told me the whole story of how, I mean, wrestling really, really affected Andy's whole life and his whole career. Because as a kid, he loved wrestling, and he was a fan of Nature Boy Buddy Rogers. That's who he thought hung the moon. And he said, I used to watch him. I was so enthralled watching Nature Boy Buddy Rogers. And he said, as I would watch him, even as a kid, he said, I realized that he was intentionally trying to make me mad or trying to make me hate him. He said, but I still liked him. And he said, that's really what I wanted to do later on in my career. He said, I'm not a comedian. I've never told a joke in my life. I hate when people call me a comedian. He said, I do performance art. He said, I go and do shows. And he said, the thing I like to do most is make my audience mad, like a heel, or make them uncomfortable. And if you look back on it, that's what Andy always did. You never really knew what Andy was really doing, because it's like you said, he made you feel uncomfortable watching whatever show he was doing.
He seemed like he was angry all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, one night, once he got to be famous, he wanted to kind of live out his childhood fantasy of being a wrestler, and he knew he wasn't physically able to do that with a man, so he started wrestling women, and he started doing it in nightclubs and where he was doing his stand-up comedy shows, and did it on Merv Griffin, he did it on Saturday Night Live, but he told me, he said, it wasn't being received the way I wanted to be, because it was never in front of wrestling fans. It was always people that had come there to see something funny or something different, and they just didn't get the wrestling thing. And so he said, I always just wanted to wrestle in front of a wrestling crowd. So he said, I think it was a show in Long Island, and Vince McMahon Sr. was there, and Andy approached him and told him what he'd like to do, that he would like to wrestle women out of the audience at a wrestling show where all the wrestling fans would get what he was trying to do, and he could be a legitimate heel. And he told me that Vince Sr. said, well, Andy, I'll tell you what, he said, I kind of like the idea, but he said, our fans are so skeptical now. He said, I'm really hesitant to involve a Hollywood actor with our shows, because I think our fans would then start thinking we're all just actors. And so he kind of blew Andy off, he didn't go for the idea. And fortunately for me, Bill Apter was there, and he was a friend of Andy's and overheard that conversation. And he called Andy off to the side and he said, hey, he said, I got a friend of mine down in Memphis, Jerry Lawler, and they had their own territory down there. And he said, I'll bet if you called him, they would bring you down for the idea. And so then after that, it was almost like the Elvis thing. I got a call from Bill Apter, and he said, hey, you ever heard of Andy Kaufman? I said, sure. I watch him every week on Taxi. He said, well, he's going to call you tomorrow. I said, what? He said, yeah, Andy Kaufman's going to call you tomorrow. He's got an idea he wants to run past you. And I didn't believe Bill. And my phone rings tomorrow, and it was Andy Kaufman calling, Mr. Lawler, this is Andy Kaufman. And so that's how it all came about.
Wow.
And really, he did just come down to wrestle women, and he was so excited, and he loved it the first time he did it. And then we brought him back a second time, and he loved that. And he was pretty much content just doing wrestling the women. And I sort of selfishly thought, man, how can I get the rub off of this big Hollywood star and get something out of this deal for myself, right? So I went to Andy and I said, man, I said, you've gone about as far as you can go with wrestling women. I said, you need to have a match with a man. And he said, oh, no, I couldn't do that. I've been hurt or whatever. I couldn't just do it. And I said, I promise you, Andy, you and I can have a match and you'll not get hurt. And it'll be the greatest thing ever. And so he came over. I showed him how to do the pile driver. I showed him how he's going to do the suplex and all that sort of stuff. And and that's just how it all went. You know, it just
How was your relationship with Andy? Did you guys become good friends during that?
Yeah, absolutely. Great friends. Yeah, he stayed at my house, and I shot all our interviews for him with my camera, and just nobody there but me and Andy in my front room. And I mean, that we shot the interview there of him showing the people a bar of soap.
Oh.
I shot the interview of him showing the people a roll of toilet paper.
Those were some of the greatest interviews of all time. All that was some of the best things I've ever seen in wrestling.
It got so much heat.
Yeah, he and I put those interviews together right there in the front room of my house, and I filmed them. And then after we only showed two, after we had about four done in the can, and after we showed the one with the toilet paper, the station manager called me up on the phone and said, "Jerry, please." I said, "What?" He said, "Please, no more Andy Kaufman hygiene in videos." And I said, "What?" He said, "Yes, it is. It's making everybody mad." And the switchboard operator is driving her crazy. That's all she gets all day long are complaints about Andy Kaufman's interviews.
Awesome. Hey, how did the Letterman interview come along? And was David aware of what you guys were going to do?
Well, it came along just out of the blue. Probably about 6 months. A lot of people don't realize that Andy and I continued to work. We had the big match with the pile drivers. He went to the hospital, stayed in the hospital for 3 days. And then he came back with his neck in a, you know, with his neck and he stayed in the hospital with his neck in traction for 3 days. Then he came back with the neck brace on, and he kept coming back. He just loved it. I mean, he was so, he told me one time, he said, "I would quit everything that I'm doing in Hollywood. I'd quit taxi, everything, if I could just stay involved with wrestling." That's how much he loved it. And so, he was still coming back. I mean, I bet we had 20 or 30 more different kind of matches. I mean, I had a boxing match with him. I had Jimmy Hart managing him, and then he turned on Jimmy Hart. And then I had matches with him and Jimmy Hart, tag team matches. And then he turned on Jimmy Hart, and I agreed to be Andy's partner against Jimmy Hart and the Assassins. And so as soon as that match started, I walked out into the ring with the Assassins, and Andy came up from behind. He'd already put powder out in his hand and tapped me on the shoulder, boom, threw the powder in my eyes. And those guys picked me up and pile drive me. And I mean, he put out a bounty to anybody that could put me in the hospital. He'd pay him $10,000. We were just going back and forth with all this and drawing terrific money in Memphis. I was tickled to death. Jerry Jarrett was tickled to death. And then all of a sudden, one day out of the blue, I get a call from Andy out in Hollywood, and he said, "Hey, you want to be on the David Letterman show?" And I went, "No, let me think about it, Andy." "Yes." "What do you mean?" "Sure I would." So he said, "Well, we can be on there next week if you want to, you know, come up to New York and everything." So, that's it. We were just going to be on the David Letterman show. And so I was so excited. Never, you know, that may have been the first time I'd ever been to New York. And so we get up there, and we have a meeting with the segment producer. They take the show at 5:30 every afternoon, and you have a meeting in the morning at like 10:30 with the segment producer. His name was Robert Morton. And so I got there at 10:30, and I went into his office, and he's sitting there by himself. And he said, "Well, Jerry," he said, "I'm sorry, but Andy refused to be in the same room with you. He told me that, you know, I had him in here earlier and told him that you were coming, and he just left. So I told him what we're going to do, and now I'll tell you that." He said he just couldn't be in the same room with me. So I said, "Okay." So the guy said, he said, "Here's what we're going to do. We're going to have you guys on for two segments. The first segment, Dave is going to show the film of you pile driving Andy, and he's going to show the footage of Andy making fun of women and making fun of Memphis and all this sort of stuff." And he said, "I'd like you guys to be a little bit antagonistic, not too much, but a little bit. And then Dave's going to take a break. And then in the second segment, Andy will apologize to you for making fun of wrestling. And then you apologize to Andy for hurting his neck. And then Andy's going to get up and sing 'What the World Needs Now Is Love, Sweet Love.'" Huh. So that was it. And so I said, "Okay, that'll be funny." So I go back to my hotel room, and Andy comes over to my room. We're staying at the same hotel. Andy comes in and says, "Well, what do you think of what they want us to do?" And I said, "Oh man," I said, that'll be funny and everything. But I said, "You got to realize if you and I go on TV, network TV, and kiss and make up and apologize to each other, that's going to be the end of us doing anything down in Memphis. And he said, I'll never forget. He said, man, you're right. And he just hesitated. And then he looked at me. He said, wonder what would happen if you just hauled off and slugged me. And I said, at the time, I said, oh, Andy, I said, we can't do that. I said, first of all, they're taping the show at 5:30. They'll never show it. I said, second of all, I'll get arrested. And I got to be back in Memphis tomorrow. You know, we just can't do that. And he said, yeah, you're right. For some reason, I don't want to be a telemarketer or whatever. But anyway, I said, we just went there later on thinking that we're going to do what Robert Morton said. And so we got out there for the first segment. And, you know, he showed the film of me pile driving him. And we got a little bit antagonistic. That's where I told him, I said, you know, his mother wanted the girl and his father wanted a boy, and they were both satisfied. And so just, you know, some different insults. And then I found out, I didn't know at the time, but I found out later during that show why he wanted us to be a little antagonistic, because I think it got down to the point where Andy said, well, I could have sued you, but I'm not that kind of guy. And I looked at him and said, what kind of guy are you? And at that point, Dave, I looked over at Dave, and he's looking down under his desk for something with his foot. And all of a sudden they had a ring bell underneath his table. And he's kicking it with his foot, right? And it goes ding, 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 ding. He said, well, we're gonna take a break here and kind of get things. We may have to get the hoses out and everything, but we'll be back with Jerry Lawler and Andy Kaufman right after this. So we go to the break, and Andy jumps up and walks away. He would not even sit there beside me while we're at break. And I'll never forget during the break, Dave Letterman leans over and says, did you know that I got started out in wrestling? I used to be the ring announcer for Dick the Bruiser up in Indianapolis. I said, no. Really? Yeah. He said, no, I never knew that. He said, yeah, sure did. Yeah. He said, yeah, I was at all the Bruiser shows up there. So anyway, they're like 10, 9, 8. He comes. Are you still there?
Yep, we're still there.
We ain't going anywhere.
Okay. So anyway, he comes back over and sits down. And so we started talking again, insulting each other and everything. And it just went on and on and on. And he never apologized to me. And I never apologized to him. And we just kept arguing back and forth. And I'm waiting any minute for him to apologize. And then finally, I guess we'd just been out there so long that Dave realized, well, you know, this ain't going as planned. This has kind of gone off the track. So I'm going to have to take a break. It was time to take a break and get that segment over with. Right. So he said, well, guys, you know, we'll get this straightened out. But right now we're going to have to take a break. And so Paul Schaefer started playing the music. And I swear to God, Dave didn't know. Andy didn't know, and I didn't know. I just, when I heard that music, I realized this is it. We're off. This is our second segment, and we're done. And I just stood up, looked Andy right in the eyes to try to give him a little hint of what was coming. And I just hauled off and slapped the snot out of him, knocked him right out of his chair. And I mean, I slapped him as hard as I could, knocked him out of his chair.
So Andy didn't know, and Dave didn't know nothing. You just decided this. I'm calling an ad lib here.
I'm going into business.
at the very last second, spur of the moment, and that's how it went down.
You felt it.
And then Andy went crazy after that, right? He went off and grabbed
it. They took me, the security took me back to the green room. And, you know, it's only a 2-minute break when you're watching it on TV for commercials. But actually, they shut down taping for about 15 minutes. And I don't know if they were talking about what to do, what in the world, should we show that? Should we arrest this guy? What should we do, right? And I'm sitting in the green room by myself. And 15 minutes goes by. At first, I would hear women screaming and stuff out there and everything. And I go, Jesus Christ, they're going a little overboard with this, right? So finally, everything quieted down. And the door kind of peeked open. And there was this little guy. And he said, it was like an intern. And he said, Mr. Lawler. Dave wants to know if you'll come back out and sort of wrap things up on this segment. I said, I'll be glad to. And so then, right then, I knew they're going to show that. Or, well, then I thought, I said, well, they may want us to try to redo that second segment. But then when I got out there and sat down, Andy was over on the side where that far door over there, they've seen the show where they come and go out of. And he's holding the side of his head. And they started the countdown, 5, 4. And Dave says, Andy, are you going to come back out here? And he says, no, if I do, I'll say words you can't say on television. So, boom, we're back on the air. And Dave said, well, we're back. And Jerry Lawler's here. And Andy's here, sort of. And some nights I wish Tom Snyder were still here. Which he used to have the show before Dave. And he said, but that's not the case now. And all of a sudden, here comes Andy in over Dave's shoulder. And he starts pounding the desk. And he let loose with the most unbelievable tirade of cussing. I mean, MF, CS, A-ho, I mean, everything you could think of. He is cussing me out like a dog. And I'm looking at him like, what the, Andy, come on, what are you doing? I mean, they're obviously going to show the slap, and there's no way they can show this, right? And so I leaned back in my chair to try to show him with my body language that, what you're doing is not cool, right? And I crossed my legs. And then he just got madder and he grabbed Dave's coffee and like, threw, but he did like I did with a slap. He grabbed Dave's coffee and he looked me in the eyes. Just like,
and then give me the Iggy.
Gave me time to move out of the way. And then I jumped up at him again and he took off. The security came and got me. And Dave just wrapped up that segment. And with the greatest line ever, Dave said, and he was clearing the coffee away in his papers, and he said, well, I think you could say some of those words on television. I've said it 1,000 times. What you cannot do is throw coffee. So anyway, that was the end of that segment. And then the security guard got me out onto the elevator, took me downstairs, took me right back to my hotel room. I didn't see Andy or anybody or didn't hear from anybody until 11:30 that night when the show came on. I turned the TV on and they showed every bit of it, everything. The only thing when the cussing came on, you could read Andy's lips so well. But they put in, instead of beeping it out, they made it even better. They put in the sound of like a cuckoo clock. So Andy was going, and then you go, cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo. And it was unbelievable. I mean, as soon as that was over, New York Post, New York Times, news people, everybody started calling immediately. And the coolest thing to me ever was the next morning, Bill Apter picked me up from the hotel and he was going to drive me around. He took pictures of me at the Statue of Liberty and the Empire State Building. And we're driving me around to do a photo shoot for the magazine that was coming out next month. And as we're driving in the taxi cab down, I don't know what street it was in Manhattan, but I looked over and I saw Rodney Dangerfield's restaurant. And of course, like I said, it was about 10:30 in the morning or whatever. I said, oh my gosh, Dangerfield's, I would love to go there. And it said appearing tonight at Red Fox. And Bill said, hey, pull over. So I told the guy to pull over and he said, I'm going to run in and see. He said, sometimes, even though Red Fox is here, sometimes Rodney Dangerfield will be here as well. And he'll just like come out and introduce the acts, you know. So he goes inside to see if Rodney's going to be there that night. And all of a sudden he comes out. He's like, oh, my gosh, come on. You're not going to believe this. I said, what? He said, Rodney's in there right now and he wants to see you so bad.
Wow.
I jump out. I go in. Here's Rodney Dangerfield in a bathrobe and a hot looking girl beside him. 10:30 in the morning. He's in a bathrobe sitting at his bar. And I come walking in. And
Wait a minute. He's in a bathrobe at his bar?
Yes. Yes.
I'm not going to say anything.
With a hot looking chick sitting right beside him. And so, it was like he was on stage. He goes, oh, my God. That was the greatest thing I ever seen last night. Oh, my God. That was the greatest thing I've ever seen on television. And apparently, Andy's manager, George Shapiro, is also Rodney Dangerfield's manager. So he was watching that, and he was good friends with Andy. He had had Andy in his club before. But yeah, he was just all over that. He said that was the greatest thing he had ever seen on television ever.
So when they took you out after the segment was over, you didn't meet with Letterman or any of the people?
Matter of fact, never forget, the security guard got me into the elevator and pushed the button down. And he said, I want to get you out of this building because Kaufman will have you arrested. He said, his elevator don't go all the way to the top floor. So let me get you out of here. And so he got me down and took me back to my hotel.
I saw Jerry where Letterman later told you when you met him later that was the one time that he felt like he lost complete control of a show. And here's a guy who had been involved in a way as an announcer with wrestling and everything. But
yeah. And he also told me, too, he said for years we referred to that as the famous show. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said that show made us famous. He said that show, that episode made us famous. He said, I'd already had two other shows on network TV that had gotten canceled. And he said, if I'd gotten canceled from this, he said, my career would have been shot. And he said, that show put us on the map.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he basically gave you credit for saving his career.
That's sort of awesome. What it sounded like.
Did you talk to Letterman after it? I know you filmed the show about Andy, the movie with Jim Carrey, but did you talk to Letterman during that time, any during that time to get his take on it?
No, never did get to talk to him. The next time I talked to him was the doing the film with Jim Carrey. And that's when he told me that they referred to it as the famous show and all of that stuff. Yeah.
How did they treat you then?
All fine, real good. But I mean, like during that, it was all set up. That was all the movie people, you know, the Man on the Moon people. And Dave just came walking in and he'd given him like, Dave didn't hardly do any of that kind of stuff. He'd never appear in any kind of movies or any kind of guest shots on shows or anything. So I think he had given him like, he said, I'll come there. And he also wouldn't do any kind of makeup to make himself look younger, like everybody else did makeup to make themselves look like they did back in 19, back when we did the thing with Andy, you know, in 82. But Dave just, he wouldn't do that. So he came on looking like the year 1999, and it was supposed to be 1982. And he told him also, he said, I got 1 hour. He said, I can do that. I can do whatever you want me to do for an hour, but after that, I got to go. So everybody was just kind of rush. And that was, Jim Carrey had been such a jerk during the filming of this movie. And this was the last scene, the last thing that we got to shoot in the movie, I guess, because of David Letterman's availability. It was the last thing we did. And I guess that Jim Carrey had forgotten that while he was being such a jerk to me, that I was going to get to slap the crap out of him in the last scene of the movie. And brother, I did. It was.
Did you?
It was harder. It was harder than I slapped Andy. I promise you.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah. Carrey was something to deal with.
Did he really throw a drink at you when you met him?
Yeah, he did. Wow. Yeah, he did. It was like, because I even went to the director, Milos Forman. I mean, Milos Forman was awesome. I mean, that guy directed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Amadeus, wow, and big name director, right? And I finally had to go to Milos and said, man, I said, Milos, says this guy, does he read the script? I mean, does he not realize that Andy and I were really friends? And he said, I'll never forget. He said, oh, Jetty, I can't do anything. He's the 800-pound gorilla. That's what he called him. So I said, I understand. And everybody during the whole filming of the movie had to refer to him as Andy. He wouldn't even talk to you if you called him Jim.
Wow.
So it was crazy. Yeah. And he threw a drink because he wanted to act. I guess he thought that Andy and I just really weren't friends. And he did. I mean, you know, he did all kinds of stuff, threw eggs at me and Stacy.
Threw eggs at you.
Yeah. When we were getting ready to film the Letterman show, we're getting out of the limousine and just going around to the front of the thing. And I was like, boom, eggs busted on the sidewalk right beside us. And I look up And there's Kerry, like two stories up and hanging out of the window.
was he trying to hit you?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
And then, and also another thing he did at in Hollywood during the filming of the movie, he sent word that that he wanted to invite, and I was out there with Stacy, who I was married to at the time. He invited Stacy in out of this real nice restaurant that he, as his guest, that he was going to, you know, meet us there and have dinner with us. Call coming in. And so we get all ready and Stacy's all primped up and everything. And we go to this real, get in a cab and go to this real nice restaurant. And we're standing around waiting. He stiffed us. He never showed up.
Oh.
What was his reason for throwing eggs, stiffing you? Was he just, he's just an idiot?
He thought that he was, he's called himself channeling Andy Kaufman. And he just thought that that was what Andy would do.
So the answer is yes, he's an idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
You know what? It's funny. Let me say, hang on 1 second. Let me show you something. I got this years later.
Years later. This is great, John.
It's awesome.
I keep it. I keep this right over here. I don't know if you can.
It says signature, but I can't read it.
Yeah.
Okay. I got this little.
Put your glasses
it's
on.
Weird. It's on, you know, it's on like parchment paper. And it says this. It says, well, first of all, I got a call out of the blue one day. And it was this woman said, Mr. Dollar. And I said, yeah. She said, I'm so-and-so. She said, I'm Jim Carrey's secretary. And he wanted to call and get your mailing address. He wants to send you something. And I mean, this is like, this is like 5 years after the movie, right? And so I said, Jim Carrey wants to send me something? And she said, yes, sir. So I give her the address. And so a few days later, a box like about this big comes in the mail. I open it up and it has this letter in it. And it says, Your Royal Highness, your wrestling outfit. Well, first of all, before I say that, somebody with the movie or something must have given him the outfit that I wore in the movie because I wanted to take it back. It's like this cool custom made robe, sort of like that one I showed you a while ago. They had this thing like that for me to wear in this wrestling scene of the movie. But I didn't, you know, I didn't get to keep it. It went back to wardrobe. But apparently somebody must have given Jim that outfit and told him it was from me. Or something, because that's the way this sounded, because it says, Your Royal Highness, your wrestling outfit is absolutely the greatest gift anybody has ever sent me. To have that piece of memorabilia from the most avant-garde moment in comedy history is a real thrill for me. Working with you was both an honor and an odyssey. I truly felt that Andy was still in charge. And I hope you'll accept this modest gift in return. I know you've done some music, so I wanted to share some treasures that I found in my record collection. But seriously, that was way beyond generous. And if you're ever in Los Angeles, please don't hesitate to call. I have a box at the Staples Center for basketball, hockey, and special events, and I would love for you to be my guest. Hail to the king, your loyal subject, Jim Carrey. And in that box was 10 vinyl record albums, all made by wrestlers. There was one by Antonio Rocca. There was one by Sweet Daddy Siki. There was, of course, the WWE wrestling album. And several more that I can't even remember who, but I guess down through the years, a lot of wrestlers had done albums and somehow he had them in his collection and he sent them all to me.
Wonderful.
So, So he stiffed you for dinner. He threw eggs at you, and then you get a slapping.
Yeah, yeah.
Did he say anything after? Did he say anything after the slap?
Yeah, here's exactly what he said.
Yeah.
When I slapped the piss out of him, he got up and he looked up at Milos and he said, "Milos, I hope you got that on that tape because I can't do it again." So that was the one thing. That was the one thing.
He wasn't going for two.
No, nobody
does. That is awesome. Have you had any contact with him other than the letter since?
No, nothing since that. No.
Unbelievable. One of the greatest stories of all time. Well, hey, King, look, we can't thank you enough for coming on. Now, we told you an hour, we kept you for almost an hour and a half. So
I know.
We apologize to you.
You know.
But you got so much history that just barely scratched the surface. So,
we didn't get into WWE. We got to have part two of this down the line, King.
Part two and part three, if King will accept.
You're right. We didn't even talk about anything in WWE. Well, we did a little bit about the WrestleMania match.
Yeah. With your highlight of your career.
Yeah.
King, like John said, man, we've been looking forward to this. You know, we've been waiting for the special time, and we finally got you over. John called me last week from Rhode Island. I guess you guys were in.
Yeah.
He said, all he said is, "We got him."
We got him.
He didn't have to say his name. I knew who he meant.
Yeah, so but you know what? I was also in the green room and I was listening to him put the hit on somebody else too about having a podcast. Who was that, JBL, that you were talking to?
Oh, your cousin.
Who was it?
Your cousin, Honky Tonk.
Oh, yeah, Honky.
Yeah.
I heard you putting a lean on him, too, to be on.
Yeah. Well, we got you. We're going to get sponsors, and now we can get anybody.
Oh, we got the king. We don't need anybody, man.
That's right. We don't need anybody else. So don't diminish the fact that I was getting Honky Tonk on the show. I hadn't seen Honky forever.
That's a top secret, man.
You know what? I put out a tweet of me and he and I together, you know, and I didn't even realize it until I looked back at the picture. There's a little bit of family resemblance because I told in the tweet, I said, not many people realize this, but Honky Tonk Man and I are first cousins. His mother and my mother are sisters.
And I saw that tweet the other day. You know, it's always rumored that you guys were always related, but I didn't know the story on how you're related.
Yeah, our mothers were sisters. So.
And we share a birthday, just not the same year. November.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, it's a small world.
King, it really is an honor. You've always been so great to me. You've always been such a good friend. I always loved working with you. We've had a lot of fun together. You are the – I always say that they argue the two best – color commentators of all time. It's you and Bobby, and then everybody else is going for third place. So
yeah, I gotta throw this in too, John. You don't maybe you do, but King and I was I'm off. I've, somehow I got off your list, but I always get a Christmas card every year from Santa Claus Lane, I believe it is 1111 Santa Claus Lane. And
it's Saint Nick Drive.
Saint Nick Drive. Yeah,
Saint Nick Drive.
Thank you. And it's a Christmas card. A few years ago, he had one of my favorite Christmas cards he ever sent me. Like I said, by the way, I got off your list somehow. I don't know if because I got fired or what. But
you must have stopped sending me a card.
That's probably it. Well, that was my wife's fault. I'll blame it on my wife. Well, I got fired, Jerry, and I couldn't afford Christmas cards. But he had this one. He had this Christmas card made up. Him and Jack at Mid-South Coliseum. And him throwing powder in my brother's eye. I think I'd have a powdery Christmas or something like that. It's the greatest Christmas card ever.
White Christmas.
Everybody have white Christmas.
Yeah, you're right. That was great.
Thank you for those, man. They're great memories.
All right, guys.